These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Years ago in New Hampshire, ticks barely registered as a problem. Today, tick warnings are everywhere. And this year, the tick forecast is especially grim. Researchers expect a bumper crop of these disease-bearing pests. But here's a little bit of good news. A research team in Boston is working on a new kind of preventative treatment. And in France, a biotech company is conducting tests of a vaccine. Still, none of this is ready in time for your outdoor adventures this summer. So today in The Exchange, we find out what you can do right now. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests in the studio, Dr. Benjamin Chan is here, New Hampshire state epidemiologist and an infectious disease physician. And Dr. Chan, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Glad also with us, Alan Eaton, UNH Cooperative Extension entomologist. Alan has been studying ticks and Lyme disease in New Hampshire for 3 decades. And Alan, always good to see you too. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And I want to let our listeners know that Alan brought in an adorable stuffed tick. So if you go to our Instagram, feed, you can check it out. It's NHPR Exchange. Alan, let's start with you. The forecast for ticks this summer, from what I've been reading, pretty grim.
It's slightly different in different parts of the state. So if I take the southeast part of the state, and by that I'm broadly meaning Merrimack County, Stratford County, Rockingham, and Hillsborough, the black-legged tick populations are actually very slightly lower than normal. But, of course, that's the highest concentration of the whole state. Whereas in the Lakes region and farther north, the populations are about normal or slightly above, which generally means less than what we've got down here. So it's a slight change from before. That's because of the drought that we had the last couple of years, and so the immatures did not survive particularly well. The biggest mortality factor for ticks is drying out, especially the immature stages.
So here in New Hampshire anyway, the drought, as problematic as it was for a lot of people, it was good in terms of keeping tick populations down. Not down to a low level, but
yes, and the same was true controlled. In parts of Massachusetts as well. If you looked at the overall drought indices and those maps, you saw that same situation. So it's a slightly lighter population, but I have to warn people not to think that all right, we can let down our guard.
Right.
No.
Well, I kept reading, and maybe this was in other parts of the Northeast, because the broader literature that I came across, Alan, I'm glad you corrected me for New Hampshire, the broader literature seems to say it's going to be a great year for
ticks. Yes.
It
indicates that. But here locally, that's our situation. So for those of us in Rockingham County and Stratford and that area, a little lower numbers than normal. But still, it's the highest tick densities, a black-legged tick anyway, in the state.
Well, and just remind us, Alan, which ticks are just gross but not dangerous, and which are gross and dangerous because they carry disease.
We've got 15 species of ticks here. Feel proud, people. New Hampshire is tick rich.
And not so sure I feel about that, but yeah.
Of those, black-legged tick is way above the most common one spreading the diseases. We have a second species called Ixodes murus that once in a while can spread it. It's not very common, and it's not spread statewide. And we have a couple of other species that occasionally will spread something like brown dog tick. But basically, a black-legged tick is the one that's responsible probably for well over 90% of the tick-borne disease cases in our state.
Well, and again, if folks aren't sure what these look like, we've got lots of pictures on our website, NHPR Exchange, also on Instagram and Twitter. So check it out if you want to see some pictures of these delightful-looking creatures. Where are the ticks, Alan, right now in their life cycle, and why does that matter?
We're dealing with, right now, both the adults of black-legged tick and the nymphs are active. And it's important that we realize that the time of year when the risk of tick-borne disease is the greatest is when the nymphs are active. And that's because they're so small, they're hard to see. But also, I personally can't feel them when they're walking on me. We posed for pictures once with one on my arm, and I'm watching it walk on my arm. I couldn't feel it.
Sure, even it's so tiny.
Yet the males, the adult males, which are 2 millimeters long, I can feel them. I can feel the females, which are 3 millimeters, and American dog tick, which is 4 millimeters or 5. But the nymphs, which are only 1 millimeter, they're so small, I can't feel them. So they're hard to see, they're hard to feel, and they actually, so that means that it's more likely that you're going to be bitten or have some walking on you and not you realize it. So you got to be actively watch and check yourself after having been outside.
Well, and a lot of us have, you know, freckles on our arms and legs or whatever. So how do you even manage to locate something that tiny?
Well, first of all, I tell people in New Hampshire we should be starting our tick checks, and I do them daily if I go outside.
Sure.
During tick season anyway. When the ticks start, which is earlier in the spring, March, and by then it's the adults. So the adults are bigger and they're easier to see, and you get practice looking for the adults. When it gets really tough, starting about May 12th or 15th is when the nymphs start, then you've got to be tougher. And I had one on my back, I thought, and I had to have help yesterday to figure out, and I had one on my shoulder, but the one on my back was a freckle. But you had to get up close to see.
Yeah.
So it takes a little bit of practice, but you get that by looking for the adults. This is the time of year to take all the precautions, the prevention, and the daily checks, the whole bit.
Well, Dr. Chan, let's talk more specifically about Lyme disease, because that's the big concern that a lot of people have with this. How severe is it here in New Hampshire, especially compared to other states?
Yeah, so New Hampshire has one of the highest rates of Lyme disease in the nation. Lyme disease, in addition to many other tick-borne diseases, are reportable in New Hampshire, which means if a doctor diagnoses someone with Lyme disease or one of these other tick illnesses, they have to report it to the health department. So we try and keep track of the number of cases, the number of individuals in New Hampshire that are diagnosed or come down with Lyme disease or some of these other tick illnesses. The last 5 years or so, the number of people diagnosed with Lyme disease has been relatively stable, but it's still quite a few people. We're talking 1,600 people reported to the health department with Lyme disease, and this is probably an underrepresentation of the actual number of people that have this disease, because there are many individuals that may go undiagnosed or unreported. Lyme disease in its early stages can mimic a lot of other illnesses. Or in fact, a lot of the tick-borne diseases, we like to talk about anaplasmosis, which is another tick-borne bacterial illness that can infect people. Babesiosis, which is a protozoan parasite that actually infects people's red blood cells. Powassan virus, Lyme disease. These are all tick-borne diseases that are out there and can be transmitted mainly through the black-legged tick, which is formerly called the deer tick, although we don't call it the deer tick anymore. So these are all diseases that people need to be aware of. Many of these diseases in the very early stages have very nonspecific symptoms, what we call flu-like illness. So, fevers, chills, muscle aches, muscle pains, just not feeling very well, which, are symptoms for a lot of different illnesses. And so people need to be aware of these symptoms and seek medical attention if they're concerned or if the symptoms persist. The one hallmark of Lyme disease that we talk about, the early symptom of Lyme disease, is called the bullseye rash. Now, it's normal for when somebody gets bitten by a tick to have a little bit of an area of an inflammatory reaction, a little red swollen area. But a bullseye rash is where you have this expanding ring of redness that looks like a bullseye, and that's a hallmark sign for Lyme disease. Now, any of these or many of these tick-borne diseases, there is effective treatment for, and so people should talk to their healthcare provider and seek medical attention if they've been bitten by a tick or are concerned about one of these tick diseases.
A quarter of people, from what I understand, Dr. Chan, don't get that bullseye rash. Is that right?
That's about right. You know, we on the flip side, we say about, you know, 70 to 80% of people will develop a bullseye rash, but you're right, about a quarter of people may not, and they can be infected. Some people will clear the infection on their own. Others that are not treated right away with antibiotics can go on to develop complications of Lyme disease. So untreated Lyme disease can cause heart complications, what we call carditis, or inflammation of the heart.
Wow.
They can have arrhythmias. People can develop central nervous system infection, and so Lyme disease can cause problems with nerves, what we call Bell palsy, can cause headaches, and a meningitis, or an inflammation of the meninges, the membranes or linings around the brain and spinal cord, and people can go on and develop swollen, painful joints.
This sounds very serious, Dr. Chan.
It is, and I think it's a big problem, especially in New Hampshire, because we have one of the highest rates of Lyme disease, and understandably, it's causing a lot of concern for our population.
You had Lyme disease at least twice, Alan. What did it feel like?
I was only in the early stages when it was stopped because I did what I recommend and I did what my physicians and the texts recommend. When I had the symptoms, I called my physician and we dealt with it. So I only got as far as a little bit of malaise, and I was one of the individuals that showed the rash. So it was helpful. And I also helped my physician by keeping records. So when I was bitten, like this one that bit me on the shoulder, I wrote on the calendar 2 inches above right shoulder. So if something appears later, then I can help my physician help me.
Now, you're a model patient, I'm guessing, in terms of that. Go ahead, Dr. Chan.
Yeah, I do want to stress that with Lyme disease, it is preventable. So the first step of prevention we like to talk about is obviously preventing the tick bite in the first place. But the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, Borrelia burgdorferi, that's the genus and species name of the bacteria, lives in the gut of the tick. And so after a tick bites somebody, it takes a certain amount of time for that bacterium to migrate from the gut of the tick into the person. And so that time frame is about 36 to 48 hours. And so if someone is bitten and they right away identify the tick and are able to remove it effectively, then there's really not a concern for Lyme disease.
You've got time.
People have time to find it. And that highlights the importance, I think, of doing tick checks to find the tick that may not be attached yet, but also find the tick that is attached so that it can be removed early before it becomes engorged, before it can transmit Lyme disease.
Well, and when does the bullseye rash show up? Once that shows up, is that an indicator, oh, I didn't get it in time and I might have Lyme disease?
Yeah, I think that's right. The bullseye rash is an early indication of infection, that somebody has Lyme disease and they need to get treated.
I want to invite our listeners again to join us, and then a lot more questions for both of you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're getting the tick forecast for summer 2017 here in New Hampshire. We're learning about some of the diseases that ticks carry. There's a lot more than just Lyme disease, unfortunately. The exchange number, again, for you to join us with your questions and comments is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Dr. Chan, picking up on something you said a moment ago, you said New Hampshire has among the highest incidence of Lyme disease. Is that partly because we report more than other states? Because you did mention how well-reported it is.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. You know, I think a lot of states are struggling with how to adequately capture and identify all these cases of Lyme disease. You know, Lyme disease was first identified down in the Connecticut area. So, you know, this was first identified in New England, and it's sort of spread out from that area ever since. And, you know, I think it highlights the difficulty of reporting, that, you know, people need to, one, be diagnosed with it in the first place, and then two, the provider has to report it to the health department. And so this is something we keep track of, but because of all the cases coming in, all the individuals being diagnosed and reported, it becomes very difficult for us, and I know other states, to adequately follow up and confirm and verify that we have this many cases in New Hampshire. But likely this is an underreporting.
Well, and it's tough for physicians too, or patients, because the symptoms you described, Dr. Chan, are just, you know, I'm feeling crummy, I'm feeling tired. You may think, I had a stressful weekend, I didn't sleep well last night, you know, whatever. It could be anything.
Yeah, and I think that's there's a challenge for both individuals that may be infected, but also physicians. Physicians, a lot of Lyme disease is diagnosed and treated by the primary care physician.
Sure.
And a primary care physician is seeing many patients throughout the day. They're dealing with infectious and non-infectious diseases, you know, having to manage somebody's diabetes, for example, and blood pressure. And then it becomes very difficult to keep this on, you know, on your radar. And so that's part of the reason why we try and do education this time of year, not only to individuals that are out and playing in the woods and in their yards, but also to healthcare providers, to making sure that tick-borne diseases are on their radar and that they know what resources are out there to help them if they have questions or think somebody may have been bitten and infected by a tick-borne disease.
Well, a couple emails have come in, gentlemen, and here's one from Walter in Alton. You mentioned the Lakes region, Alan, earlier. He says, we went for a walk through the woods yesterday morning with our dogs. I came back with over a dozen, he says, on me. And one of our dogs also had that many. These were large ticks and none were attached yet, so I think we're fine. Did a thorough tick check later in the day to make sure we didn't miss any. Walter says, definitely a lot of ticks out there right now. I have a very particular question for you, Alan. Oh. You know, Walter says he was out walking in the woods. I went for a walk in the woods on Friday after preparing for this show, which probably wasn't a very good idea. Are the ticks mostly in the grasses, or are they sort of in the dry leaves on the path? I mean, if you're walking in the woods on sort of a standard, well-maintained dirt path, are ticks waiting in the dirt to jump on you, or is it more a problem when you're sort of, you know, walking through the brush?
They're more likely right at the edge of the path. And when I had a dog, my dog would always wander everywhere else and go all through. You couldn't keep, like, can't keep them right on the path. If you stay right in the center and don't contact any vegetation, who does that? Then you're less likely to encounter them. But they're on the vegetation, and typically low vegetation. If we're talking about black-legged tick, it's more likely on deciduous shrubs and really low, the lower several inches. Not so much on conifer shrubs. If we're talking about American dog tick, they're a little bit more likely to be in tall grass. But it's in the vegetation.
All right. Well, let's take a call, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Walter, thanks for that email. And Ryan's joining us from Hanover. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Just had a couple of questions. One was related to the progress on vaccines for things like Lyme disease, tick-borne illnesses. And then the other question that I had was, are there any diseases that where the tick does not need to be attached for a 36-hour period, it could be attached for a shorter period of time?
Oh, Ryan, thank you so much. Great questions. And let's talk about the vaccine first, Dr. Chan. I also got an email from Jackie in Campton who says, do I remember correctly that 20, 30 years ago there was a Lyme disease vaccine and that the manufacturer discontinued it because they weren't making money on it? So a couple folks, Dr. Chan, who want to know about a vaccine.
Yeah, that's a great question. And your listener and respondent are correct. There used to be a Lyme vaccine for humans. That was taken off the market. I don't know the exact date. I want to say it was around the year 2000 or so. Because of poor uptake, it was apparently poorly tolerated. People were complaining about the vaccine causing side effects, muscle aches, joint pains. And so the manufacturer took it off the market, and it wasn't a great vaccine anyway in terms of producing immunity in somebody. And so it hasn't been reintroduced, or there has not been a new vaccine reintroduced. To my knowledge, there is not another vaccine that is at least close to coming out for Lyme disease that I'm aware of. There is a vaccine for pets and animals, for a veterinary vaccine, but not for humans, and I'm not aware of one on the horizon.
All right, well, some tests, but you're right, nothing that I have heard about coming to market anytime soon. But coming up, we'll talk to somebody at UMass Medical who has another type of preventative treatment. We'll find out about that in just a moment, and we'll take more of your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Civics 101 is a podcast that wonders about things you might have learned in school but have since forgotten, like what does a White House chief of staff actually do and how does gerrymandering work? NHPR's Civics 101 is your guide to what you need to know. Subscribe to this and all of NHPR's podcasts. Cloudy with some showers today. High temperatures upper 40s to mid-50s. It'll be cloudy with showers tonight. Overnight lows in the lower 40s. Then tomorrow, turning partly to mostly sunny with high temperatures in the lower 70s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the New England Honda dealers. Dedicated to style, technology, and safety, qualities displayed in the 2017 Accord. Information at HondaDealersOfNewEngland.com. And UNH's MBA programs, full-time, online, and part-time in Durham and Manchester. GMAT waived with 5 years' experience. Accepting applications for the fall at mba.unh.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the tick forecast for New Hampshire 2017 and some new research on tick habitat and Lyme disease prevention. We'd love to hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions, comments, and observations, as we've received from several listeners already, are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And so, Dr. Chan, just before the break, Ryan had a couple questions about ticks and tick-borne diseases, and he asked about other tick-borne diseases besides Lyme disease that unfortunately infect the body a lot more quickly than the Lyme infection.
That's right. And the 36 to 48 hours that I mentioned that it takes for the bacteria that causes Lyme disease to migrate from the gut of the tick into the person or pet or animal is for Lyme disease. And your caller is absolutely correct in questioning whether other diseases, other infections can be transmitted much sooner. And the answer is yes. Some of these other infections, anaplasmosis, babesiosis, powassan, these can be transmitted in much, much shorter time frames. I don't know the exact numbers, but certainly, you know, within hours of being attached.
All right. And a lot more reason to do a better job with prevention, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the preventative techniques out there. I want to bring another voice into our conversation, gentlemen. With us now on the line is Dr. Mark Klempner. He's a professor of medicine at UMass Medical School, also executive vice chancellor at a lab called Mass Biologics. And Dr. Klempner, it's really nice to have you. Thank you for taking time out.
Thank you, and good morning.
You've been working on a treatment, not necessarily a vaccine, but a treatment called Lyme PrEP. I've seen it described as seasonal prevention. What does that mean, Dr. Klempner?
So we at Mass Biologics of the University of Massachusetts Medical School have been exploring a new but very old method for passive immunity. So the notion when you take a vaccine is that you expose the person to either a innocuous form of the microorganism that you're trying to prevent, or you give them a piece of it. And then you let the immune system respond to that with a whole host of immune responses, principally antibodies, a whole host of antibodies, and then maybe some cell responses as well. We know that at least one of those antibodies, an anti-OspA antibody in particular, is perfectly able to prevent the transmission of the Lyme disease bacteria from the tick to the person. And we learned that from the former effective vaccine studies. So what we've done is we've focused in on isolating that particular antibody, making it in a steel tank where it can be made to high purity and specificity, and then providing that specific antibody to the animal, a person, or in this case, when the preclinical studies are done with animals, and then expose the individual or the animal to the infected ticks. And that antibody that's now circulating serves as the new prevention. So we call it Lyme pre-exposure prophylaxis with a specific single monoclonal antibody.
So it's kind of like a flu vaccine where it wouldn't work for your whole life, but, you know, seasonally it would work.
Correct. It would depend on the half-life or duration that the antibody that we would administer to you would circulate in your body. And typically antibodies only circulate for a month or so. What we've done is looked at antibodies that we can extend their half-life so that they would circulate for 6 or 7 months at a high enough concentration that they would be preventative, and then they would be gone during the time that you really don't need them. You're not usually exposed. And then you'd get readministered the next year.
Wow. So you've been quoted as calling this drug a game changer, Dr. Klempner. How so?
Well, you know, I think that there is great concern about off-target effects from vaccines. And we're trying to address that concern by making this with a very specific antibody that we know works, and we know these monoclonal antibodies are safe. There's a really good precedent for this, where we give premature babies a monoclonal antibody to prevent them from getting respiratory syncytial virus, the most common cause of premature babies' respiratory illnesses that cause hospitalization. And we've been using that antibody for over a decade now, and it has been incredibly safe. So we know that giving passive monoclonal antibodies to even the most vulnerable populations is highly safe and effective. And we're trying to build on that long tradition of being able to provide a specific, one specific antibody to prevent Lyme disease.
So we've talked a little bit before you came on with us, Dr. Klempner, about other tick-borne diseases, especially powassan, which is pretty concerning. Would this offer protection against those other diseases as well, or just Lyme?
It would not. It is designed to be quite specific. If you were to try and expand it to other pathogens, you would have to create a cocktail of the monoclonal antibodies that might work. Similarly, if you're trying to prevent more than one disease with a vaccine, you need to have multiple vaccine components in there. So it would not prevent the other infectious diseases, but that would certainly not be a reason not to try and prevent this one.
Sure. Well, a report on your efforts last year, Dr. Klempner, said this may never get out of the lab due to a lack of funding. What's the status now, Dr. Klempner, of bringing this Lyme PrEP to market?
Right. So, you know, there we have made a lot of progress over the past year in actually doing the studies to define the half-life or how long it would able to be circulate. And we're there now. Right now, you know, we are part of a university laboratory system. We don't typically have the resources to commercialize medicines. We usually partner with pharmaceutical enterprises for that. And that's where we are right now, is that we're talking to a number of larger pharmaceutical companies that, you know, we would need to partner with in order to move it into the clinic.
Have you done this on yourself, Dr. Klempner?
Have I done it on myself?
Yeah.
Have I given myself the monoclonal
antibody?
Right.
I mean, I don't even know if that's ethically allowed, but
no.
I thought I'd ask.
You know, you first have to manufacture it to the standard that is available to so-called GMP standard for giving it to people.
Sure.
And we have not gotten the funds yet to manufacture it to that standard. So, no, I have not given it to myself. I did participate in the very early vaccine studies and did take the vaccine when it was available in the earlier, in the 2000s.
Yeah, about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if once it is available, or at least to be tried on humans, maybe not on to market, but at least in testing, I wonder if you'll be first in line.
I certainly will be.
All right. Dr. Klempner, great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Mark Klempner, professor of medicine at UMass Medical School, and executive vice chancellor at a lab called Mass Biologics. The number for you to join us as we talk about ticks in summer 2017 here in the Granite State is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. Lots of questions have come in, gentlemen. And here's one from Karina. Are ticks found at altitudes, i.e. at the top of the White Mountains? Karina, thank you for the question. Alan?
Unlikely. It's probable that there's some there, but the greatest mortality factor for ticks, all the species that we have anyway, is drying out. And so at high altitudes and exposed situations where you're drying out a lot, both in cold weather and in warm weather, not so likely. So pretty unlikely in those scenarios. Not impossible.
But and the from what I understand from looking at the maps, Alan, northern New Hampshire, Coas County has less of a tick population than in southern and central parts of the state.
Black-legged tick is now in every county in our state, but the one county that has the lowest numbers is Coas.
Okay, because cold winters kill them off or drying out or a combination?
I think it's because they just haven't quite reached that far north yet in significant numbers. It takes them time, but it could also be that there are other factors that are affecting them.
Okay, and we have coming up in a couple minutes someone who looks a lot at habitat fragmentation, and that may also be a factor in protecting the North Country at this point. Here's another email that came in from Angie. I've heard that doxycycline is a recommended treatment if you suspect you've been infected with Lyme disease, yet none of my friends have been prescribed this. Angie says, also, when I lived in Africa, we all took doxy on a daily basis to prevent getting malaria. Why don't we do that here? Interesting questions, Angie. Thank you so much. First of all, Dr. Chan, I've also heard that even if you suspect you've been infected, they'll just give you what's called a Z-Pak, you know, a quick hit of antibiotics. Is that right?
So what it sounds like what your listener is asking about is a one-time dose of doxycycline to prevent development of or the early symptoms of Lyme disease. And this is, in fact, one of the recommended methods of preventing somebody from developing Lyme disease if the tick has been attached for more than 36 hours. And so, again, it goes back to if somebody finds a tick, they remove it right away, or they remove the tick within 36 hours, meaning it doesn't appear to be engorged, then generally there's nothing that somebody has to worry about in terms of developing Lyme disease. If, however, somebody finds a black-legged tick and they don't know how long it's been on there, but it's been engorged, or they think, you know, they were outdoors 2 days ago and think they got the tick 2 days ago, then there is a one-time dose of doxycycline, which is an antibiotic, which can be given and has been shown to be effective at preventing the development of the early symptoms, the erythema migrans or the bullseye rash of Lyme disease.
So doctors will give it to you even if you're not 100% sure that you were bitten by an infected tick, just in case.
That's correct. And in fact, you know, testing ticks is not generally recommended as part of routine medical care to identify whether somebody's at risk or not. So the fact that somebody may have been bitten and the tick is engorged is usually enough reason to prescribe a one-time dose of a preventive course of antibiotics, a one-time dose. Now, the treatment for Lyme disease with doxycycline is usually, you know, a couple of weeks of antibiotics. So if somebody is bitten and they know they have Lyme disease, they know that they're infected, they have symptoms of Lyme disease, the treatment is, you know, to up to 3 weeks of this antibiotic doxycycline. If they don't know if they're infected, but they were bitten by a tick, the recommendation is for a one-time dose of a doxycycline.
What about Angie's other question, Dr. Chan? When I lived in Africa, we all took doxy on a daily basis to prevent getting malaria.
Yeah, so doxycycline is an antibiotic, but it has other uses. You know, malaria is a parasite that's transmitted through the bite of a mosquito. And can be used for prophylaxis. Somebody has to take malaria prophylaxis, which may include doxycycline. It's not always the drug of choice. For the duration that they're, you know, exposed to these potential mosquitoes to prevent getting malaria, that's in fact not one of the recommendations, I think, for people living in New Hampshire to take long courses of doxycycline to prevent Lyme disease, because we're living in a what we call a Lyme endemic state, meaning Lyme is all around us. And so we just need to focus, I think, more on preventing the tick bites and preventing, you know, ticks in general.
A Lyme endemic state. That's
yes.
Not a very pretty headline, Dr. Chan. What do you think, Alan?
Be proud, New Hampshire people.
Well, and we've got a lot more questions from our listeners about prevention, and we will definitely get to those. But I also want to bring another important voice into our conversation. With us now is Richard Ostfeld. He's a disease ecologist at the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies, where he researches tick-borne disease ecology. And Richard Ostfeld, really nice to have you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I've been doing a lot of reading about your research, Rick, and you talk a lot about acorns and ticks. Now, just draw the lines for us, if you could, please. What's the connection between acorns and ticks?
Yeah, it sounds a bit strange, but it's real, and we've discovered this through about 25 years of monitoring tree seed production, white-footed mice and other creatures of the forest floor, and also black-legged ticks and their infection with tick-borne pathogens, as well as doing some experiments back in the 90s. And the basic idea is that the oak trees that dominate many of our forests in the Northeast, including many parts of New Hampshire, have a strange behavior whereby every 4 or 5 years they cut loose with a huge bumper crop of acorns.
A mast year, right? That's what they call it.
A mast year, uh-huh. That's right. And so, you know, people are familiar with these because sometimes hiking up a hill is very difficult because it's almost like you're walking on ball bearings. There's so many acorns underfoot. So those acorns are very nutritious. They're filled with proteins and lipids, and at least some of them, some species of acorn have a very long shelf life. So wildlife love to eat them and to store them. And one of the key wildlife that does so is the white-footed mouse, which is probably the most common vertebrate animal, certainly the most common small mammal in our part of the world, the northeastern U.S. So they store these acorns and survive winter really well at a very high rate when acorns are available, much higher than when acorns are scarce. They begin breeding very early. They get a jump start on their reproductive season. And so by the following summer, the white-footed mice have reached a population peak. So you might find 200-300 mice per acre of the forest after a good acorn year, whereas you might get, you know, just 2 or 3 or 10 in a non-acorn year.
That's a huge difference. I didn't realize it was that big.
No, it's enormous, and you know these white-footed mice are they're cryptic. They're nocturnal. They're very quiet and secretive. You don't even know they're out there because you don't see them. But boy, oh boy, when they are abundant, they are doing lots of things out in the forest, including eating gypsy moth pupae and controlling gypsy moth outbreaks. They attack the eggs and nestlings of songbirds. Believe it or not. But one of the things that's very important to us that they do is that they act as a host for the baby ticks, the larval stage of the black-legged tick. And that's important because they tend to be a high-quality host for the tick, meaning that larval ticks that happen to find a white-footed mouse tend to survive well. They don't get groomed off. They don't get killed by the host, which is something that other hosts are very good at doing. The mice basically shrug them off. They don't bother grooming. And so the ticks survive well, and they also have a very high probability of getting infected if they bite a white-footed mouse.
So happy, prevalent, abundant mice means happy, prevalent, abundant ticks, Rick.
That's correct. But there's one little twist to the story, which is that it all takes an additional year to play out in terms of human risk of exposure to tick-borne disease. So these baby ticks, the larvae, will have access to numerous mice the summer following an acorn year. Those larval ticks bite the mice. They survive well. They get infected so that the next spring and early summer, so that is now 2 years following the acorn year, that's when the nymphs come out in an infected state, so with a very high probability of being infected, and that's when our risk goes up.
So
it's true not only of Lyme disease, but also of babesiosis and anaplasmosis. The mice are the main source of infection for the baby ticks.
Well, and Rick, we'll pick up after a short break because I've got a couple more questions for you on that connection with the mice, and other questions for our guests in studio, too. Alan Eaton with UNH Cooperative Extension and Dr. Benjamin Chan, New Hampshire State Epidemiologist. So hold on, Rick. We'll be right back after a short break. You can join us, too, with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Check out some pictures on Instagram. It's NHPR Exchange.
This is NHPR. It's 9:39.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Next time on 1A, a summit with the Saudis. President Trump picked Saudi Arabia for his first official visit abroad. We'll consider America's controversial relationship with the House of Saud and why the president brought country star Toby Keith along for the ride. Next time on 1A.
That's this morning at 10 o'clock here on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the New Hampshire State Parks license plates, allowing access to limitless outdoor adventures in New Hampshire State Parks. Learn more at nhstateparks.org. And Plymouth State University, offering graduate degrees that bring dream careers closer, just off I-93. More at plymouth.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the tick forecast for New Hampshire for summer 2017. Also, some new research on tick habitat and Lyme disease prevention. Give us a call. We'd love to take your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. With us for the rest of the hour is Alan Eaton. He's with UNH Cooperative Extension. He's an entomologist who's been studying ticks and Lyme disease in New Hampshire for a long time. Dr. Benjamin Chan is here, New Hampshire state epidemiologist and an infectious disease physician. And with us now from New York is Richard Ostfeld. He's a disease ecologist at the Carey Institute of Ecosystem Studies. And gentlemen, before we go back to the phones, Rick, just one more question for you as you look at this really fascinating connection between acorns and fat and happy mice, which means fat and happy ticks. And then that has impacts on us, obviously. So just put us up to date on the calendar, please, Rick. So the last year was a great one for acorns, right? That mast year?
So the mast year was 2015. Right. And so 2016 was our mouse plague that we experienced locally in our woods, as well as in my kitchen and basement. And so it is right around now, May, June, July, when the nymphs come out. And so it is right around now that we're expecting risk to increase.
Okay. Thank you for that happy news, Rick. So this is the time.
Sorry.
This is the time. The bumper crop of acorns this 2 years ago means bumper crop of ticks this year.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Chan, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in and say that, you know, every year people ask us, you know, when do the ticks come out? When do the mosquitoes come out? And unfortunately, historically, we haven't had a great way of assessing that. We have recently gone and looked at some of our surveillance data that we have. So we have a surveillance system that can look at hospital emergency room data in real time as part of what we call syndromic surveillance. And we've done that and looked for emergency room encounters specifically for tick bites. And what's interesting is that we found the tick bites, people go to the ER for tick bites starting even as early as March and April.
Wow.
And it begins to peak. It begins to peak in May. And so, you know, we're well into tick season now, which I think highlights the need to focus on sort of prevention and identifying ticks.
Let's take some more calls, gentlemen. And Jamie's in New Boston. Hi, Jamie. You're on the air. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for this great show. I have a question about testing, and I have a question about chemical sprays to wear outside. So my question about testing is I'm familiar with Igenix in California. I've also heard about a testing place in Stony Brook, New York. And recently I just had a tick bite, and the doctor was sending – I said, where are you sending the – where am I going to have that blood work sent? And she said it was just locally. So I had Lyme disease, was diagnosed with it many years ago, too, and had an Igenix test. And I also know that the level of testing varies. At least I know it financially from a $200 test up to a $600 test.
So questions about the testing, Jamie.
Testing.
Yeah. Was there something else you wanted to ask as well?
Yeah, about chemical sprays.
Sure.
Is it DEET? Is it pyrethium?
Great question. And let's handle both of those. And to you first, I think, Dr. Chan, I've also gotten calls from listeners over the years wondering, you know, where the best testing is done. Some people say they feel like the local testing isn't good enough, yeah. isn't thorough
that's
enough.
That's a great question, and understandably, I think there's confusion out there. The test for Lyme disease or for any of these tick-borne diseases can actually be done through anybody's local hospital. Local hospitals use or have access to reference laboratories that perform Lyme testing that, according to the CDC, recommended testing, and that's FDA approved. It has appropriate certification and oversight to make sure that the laboratories are detecting Lyme when it's there and not detecting Lyme when it's not there. There are some private labs out there, and your caller mentioned Igenix. This is one of the well-known private labs that has developed their own testing. And unfortunately, some of these privately developed tests are not FDA approved. They don't follow the CDC recommendations. And so the quality of the testing, I think there's some question around it. And so we don't recommend that people use these labs. People should be able to get tested very easily through their local healthcare provider and their local laboratories.
Well, and let's talk about some of the chemical sprays. Jamie, I'm so glad you asked. I had this conversation with my family just this weekend. You know, how much should we get permethrin, if I'm pronouncing that right, Alan, DEET, and so forth. So can you answer Jamie's question, Alan, please, about the best chemical sprays to use?
And actually, there's a couple situations here. One group of the materials are repellents, and there's another group that actually are toxicants. They actually kill the ticks. So amongst the repellents, DEET is the material that seems to be the most effective. But thank goodness for those of you allergic to DEET, there are other options. IR35 is one of them. Picaridin is another. Undecanone is a third active ingredient. You've got to look on the label of the product to look for the active ingredients to find out which ones are which. And so those are the kinds of materials you would look for. I've got a publication I wrote on those on the repellents. But also, permethrin is a material that is sort of classified as a repellent. It's an insecticide, a synthetic, which when sprayed on your clothing, adheres extremely tenaciously to cotton and repels ticks for a long, long time. And so that's an option here that you can get in outdoor stores, hunting, fishing supply places. And so that's an option, too. Technically, it's not a repellent, but it's sort of classified that way.
So the ticks just, if I had permethrin-treated socks, they just wouldn't bother climbing up my socks? Is that right?
They're repelled by it as they start to die, so they fall off.
Wow.
And it's extremely effective. And so there are those. So the DEET and the permethrin are probably the two that are the most effective. Both of those are synthetics. There are natural options. They are not as effective.
Well, in fact, I have a question from a listener on that. Joan in Warner says, I'm especially interested in concocting my own essential oils. I see various recipes, but would like to know which ingredients research has shown work best. Trial and error may tell me, but what do you know about the most effective ingredients in homemade repellents? And I've seen a lot of these, you know, oregano-based or other things, Alan, at the natural food store. Do these work?
Yes. In fact, some of them that are essential oils, those are some of the most effective of the natural products. And in fact, for those people that are trying to kill ticks, in other words, an insecticide you spray on your property, there's a material called Essentria, which is made up of essential oils of a number of different things and works quite effectively and is a really viable option for people who really don't want to spray a synthetic on their things. They're looking for a natural option. So there's that. There's another material called MET-52. That's a brand name. It's a Metarhizium anisoplii, an insect-killing fungus. So there are synthetics when we talk about the insecticides and acaricides, and there are natural products as well. So some of them can work.
And again, if people want all the information, we've put a lot of links on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, to Department of Health and Human Services, to UNH Cooperative Extension. Rick, I have another question for you, but Dr. Chan, you want to jump in first?
Yeah,
there.
I just wanted to mention that I think it's important to clarify that. So insect repellents, typically we recommend for bare skin. And the different components of the repellents last different periods of time. So it's not just whether or not they repel ticks. It's also the length of time and when people may need to reapply them. And DEET, the reason why DEET is so often recommended is because it tends to offer longer lasting protection. And there's more information on this on the EPA website, the Environmental Protection Agency website, where they have a, you know, find the right insect repellent for you sort of search function. The permethrin is meant to be applied to clothing, and you let it dry, and it actually lasts through several washes. So insect repellent to bare skin, permethrin to clothing, and both of these can help prevent tick bites.
You know, looking more at the landscape and how, in some instances, that actually encourages tick development. Rick, I've got a question for you here from Max in Manchester. He said, I heard opossums like to eat ticks. Is this true, and what else preys on ticks? And this is something you've looked at, Rick, so I'd love to hear from you on this.
Yeah, that's right. So what we have found is that these black-legged ticks, essentially all three biting stages, but we've focused mostly on the larval and nymphal stages, they are happy to feed on almost any warm-blooded vertebrate, so mammal or bird, that happens to walk by or hop by close enough for them to grab a hold. Some of these hosts, when the tick is on them, are really good at finding them and grooming them off, and often that results in the death of the tick. And opossums are, so far, the world champions at grooming off and killing ticks. And what we've found in lab and field studies is that opossums kill about 95% of the larval ticks, larval stage ticks, that try to bite them. And we've estimated that an individual opossum can kill up to several thousand larval ticks per week during the peak of the larval stage.
Wow, I want to adopt one, Rick.
So, yeah, I mean,
in my yard, right?
There may be some other drawbacks. I mean, if you've ever got up close and personal to opossums, that might change your mind.
Yeah, I've seen one wandering around, actually. Yeah, go ahead.
Hoovering up ticks, but what they're doing is they're killing the ticks that have crawled onto their fur and are trying to find a nice place to bite and suck their blood. There are very few animals that actually make their living going around looking for ticks in the environment and killing them. There's some folklore about this. There's a paper that was published many years ago, back in, I think, the mid-90s. I believe it was Christie Brinkley's first and only scientific paper, on which she was a co-author, suggesting that guinea fowl were very good at hoovering up ticks, just going out and pecking and eating ticks. There have been some attempts to repeat that kind of study that have shown that guinea fowl actually are not terribly effective. They'll occasionally nibble on a tick, but they're not the panacea. They're not vacuuming up the ticks and making life safer for everyone. There are very few animals that make their living eating ticks, especially in our part of the world. So the opossums are helpful, but again, that's only because they're eating the ticks that are trying to bite them. They're getting bitten back.
Well, and you've written a ton, Rick, about fragmented landscapes and how that helps ticks. So first of all, just describe, please, what a fragmented landscape looks like.
Well, this would be a landscape. You know, most of the Northeast, most of New England was more or less 90% forested at the time when the colonials invaded from Europe. So the native landscape is largely forested. What humans are very good at doing is chopping that forest up into small bits. That's what we mean by when we say fragmentation. So we're putting suburban developments, we're putting agriculture, we're putting industry in place of the forest and taking away that forested land. When you do that, when you chop up native forest into small bits, you tend to make life very difficult for certain species of animals. Those are particularly the more predatory animals, the larger bodied animals, those that need more extensive habitat in which to maintain a viable population. When they go away, when these predators, large-bodied animals disappear or decline, That makes life much better for things like white-footed mice and chipmunks and shrews, these small mammals that no longer are being preyed upon to the same degree. And they tend to thrive in these landscapes that are chopped up and degraded and fragmented.
So when you get rid of the foxes and the bobcats and so forth, those are the animals that would typically eat mice, and now they're not preying on the mice, so the mice are having a great time.
Yes, that's exactly right. And what that means is that more ticks feed on mice and more of them survive and get infected and then will later potentially encounter us.
Alan, jump in here, please. You've looked at the maps of New Hampshire. Where do you see especially these fragmented landscapes where, as Rick is telling us, larger predators can't come in and dine on mice, and so the mice thrive and so do the ticks?
It's hard for me to judge because I don't have access to maps and so forth that are old enough to see, but it appears that much of the southern two-thirds to three-quarters of our state are what ecologists would call fragmented. So he's right on the money on that one.
Wow. So here's the million-dollar question for you, Rick, maybe first. If the increase in fragmented landscapes makes us more likely to be exposed to some of these pretty bad diseases that ticks carry, how do you go about fixing that? I mean, it's already fragmented. You can't take an axe to, you know, the homes and businesses that are located in that former forest or field. So what do you do, Rick?
Well, it's a great question. And so I think we need to take several different approaches. One is that if we have areas that have not already been fragmented, and there is a plan for development underway, that I would say that tick-borne disease is a big enough problem that it should inform the way in which the landscape is developed so that we can preserve as large and undisturbed, unfragmented patch of forest or area of forest as we can, if there is such an option, and we should try to assure that there is. If the landscape is already fragmented, we've suburbanized it, we're not going to tear down all the houses and replant with trees, then what I think what our work suggests is that we can pinpoint the riskiest areas, the places with the highest abundances of ticks, and target them for environmentally safe and effective means of controlling tick populations. Unfortunately, we're not going to airdrop thousands of opossums or bobcats, for that matter, into these areas and hope that they'll stick around. You know, I wish it were true, but I don't think it's realistic. But Met 52 was mentioned a little while ago. So that's this fungus that's a native fungus that is very effective at killing ticks. And we have a project going on right now called the Tick Project. I know it's very creative, that is attempting to control ticks aggressively enough at a neighborhood scale using Met 52, this fungus spray that kills ticks but is environmentally safe and safe for people and pets, to reduce our exposure to infected ticks. So we can target when we know risk is high, and that can be helpful in efficiency and safety.
Well, and I have to wrap it up here, and I apologize because there's so many more questions from our listeners that we didn't get to, but I want to let everybody know there's a lot more resources, again, on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. So hopefully you can get your questions answered there. I also want to thank our guests for being with us. Rick Ausfeld, it was really good to have you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
That's Richard Ausfeld, disease ecologist at the Cary Institute for Ecosystem Studies. And Alan Eaton, thank you as always for bringing in icky pictures and
thank you, Laura.
And so forth. And we'll put all your information on our website, of course. Alan, thanks so much. And Dr. Chan, thank you also for taking time out. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. Benjamin Chan, New Hampshire State epidemiologist and an infectious disease physician. Alan Eaton, also UNH Cooperative Extension. He's been studying ticks and Lyme disease in New Hampshire for 3 decades. As I said, the conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. Lots of resources there for you as well. And again, if you want to check out some fun behind the scenes pictures of The Exchange, you can check us out on Instagram. It's NHPR Exchange. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes or Google Play for NHPR Exchange.
The Exchange brings it all to you every morning live at 9. We're New Hampshire's only statewide call-in program covering the issues that matter to the Granite State. And you shape that coverage with your calls and emails. I'm Laura Canoy, host of The Exchange. Be part of a statewide conversation and join us every morning live at 9 here on NHPR.
Next at 10 o'clock on NHPR, where support comes from your listeners and from White River Indie Festival, showcasing local and international films June 1st through the 4th at the Baretti Center for the Arts in downtown White River Junction, WRIF.org. And from Portsmouth Christian Academy, with advanced placement classes and an enrollment option with Southern New Hampshire University to earn college credit while attending high school, PCAschool.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at